A constricting pain in Hugh's chest nearly suffocated him. He couldn't breathe. For long moments he couldn't see. And it wasn't the darkness of the ship's interior that was blinding him. It was fear, he told himself. Fear that the child had found out. Shaking his head to rid his eyes of the shadow that had fallen over them, he turned to look hard at the boy. But Bane was gazing up at him with innocent affection, not cunning guile. Hugh jerked his hand roughly out of the child's grasp. "That cabin's where you and Alfred'll sleep," he said. "Stow the packs there." A thud and a muffled groan sounded from above them. "Alfred, get down here and take care of His Highness. I've got work to do."
"Yes, sir,"
came the quavering return, and Alfred slid, literally, down the ladder, landing on the deck in a heap. Turning on his heel, Hugh stalked off toward the steerageway, shoving past Alfred without saying a word.
"Merciful Satan,"
said the Chamberlain, backing up to avoid being run down. He stared after Hugh, then turned to Bane.
"Did you say or do anything to upset him, Your Highness?"
"Why, no, Alfred,"
the boy said. Reaching out, he took hold of the Chamberlain's hand.
"Where did you put those berries?" "Can I come in?"
"No, stay in the hatchway," Hugh ordered. Bane peeked inside the steerageway, and his eyes widened in astonishment. Then he giggled.
"It looks like you're stuck in a big spider's web. What are all those ropes hooked to? And why are you wearing that contraption?"
The contraption Hugh was strapping on himself resembled a leather breastplate, except that it had numerous cables attached to it. Extending in various directions, the cables ran upward into a complicated system of pulleys fixed to the ceiling.
"I've never in my life seen so much wood," Alfred's voice floated into the steerageway. "Not even in the royal palace. The wood alone must make this ship worth its weight in barrels. Your Highness, please keep back. Don't touch those cables."
"Can't I go over and look out the windows? Please, Alfred, I won't get in the way."
"No, Your Highness," Hugh said. "If one of these cables wrapped around your neck, it would snap it in a second."
"You can see well enough from where we're standing." "Quite well enough," said Alfred, looking slightly green around the mouth.
The ground was far below them. All that could be seen were the tops of trees and the side of a coralite cliff. Harness firmly fastened in place, Hugh settled down on a high-backed wooden chair that stood on one leg in the center of the steerageway. The chair swiveled to the left and the right, allowing the pilot easy maneuvering. Sticking up out of the floor in front of him was a tall metal lever.
"Why do you have to wear that thing?"
Bane asked, staring at the harness.
"It keeps the cables in easy reach, prevents them from getting tangled, lets me know which cable goes where."
Hugh nudged the lever with his foot. A series of startling bangs resounded through the ship. The cables whirled through the pulleys and snapped taut. Hugh pulled on several of the cables attached to his chest. There came various creaking and rumbling sounds, a sharp jerk, and they could feel the ship lift slightly beneath their feet.
"The wings are unfolding," said Hugh. "The magic is activating."
A crystal globe sextant, located directly above the pilot's head, began to gleam with a soft blue light. Symbols appeared within it. Hugh pulled harder on the cables, and suddenly the treetops and the cliffside began to drop out of sight. The ship was rising. Alfred gasped. Losing his balance, he staggered backward, clinging to the bulwarks for support. Bane, jumping up and down, clapped his hands. Suddenly the cliff and the trees vanished, and the vast expanse of clear blue sky stretched endlessly before them.
"Oh, Sir Hugh, may I go to the upper deck? I want to see where we're going."
"Absolutely not, Your High..."
began Alfred.
"Sure," interrupted Hugh. "Take the ladder we used coming down. Keep hold of the rails and you won't get blown off."
Bane scampered away, and in another moment they could hear his boots clomp overhead.
"Blown off," gasped Alfred. "It's not safe."
"It's safe. The elven wizards put a magical canopy around it. He couldn't even jump off. As long as the wings are extended and the magic's working, he'll be all right."
Hugh flicked Alfred an amused glance.
"But you might want to go up and keep an eye on him all the same."
"Yes, sir," said the Chamberlain, swallowing. I'll do just that."
But he didn't move, clinging with death-like grip to the bulwarks, his rigid face white as the clouds sailing past them. Alfred stared fixedly out to the blue sky.
"Alfred," said Hugh, tugging on one of the cables.
The ship dipped to the left, and a glimpse of treetops sprang suddenly and dizzyingly into view.
"I'm going, right now, sir, I'm going," said the Chamberlain, not moving a muscle.
Up on the deck, Bane leaned over the rail, entranced by the sight. He could see Pitrin's exile sliding away behind him. Below him and before him were blue sky and white clouds. Above him sparkled the firmament. The dragon wings extended on either side, their leathery skin barely rippling with the motion of the ship's passage. The center wing stood up straight behind him, swaying slightly back and forth. Holding the feather in his hands, the boy brushed it idly back and forth across his chin. The ship is controlled by the harness. Magic keeps it afloat. The wings are like bat's wings. The crystal on the ceiling tells you where you are. Standing on tiptoe, he stared down below him, wondering if he could see the maelstrom from this high up. "It's easy, really," he remarked, twiddling the feather. Chapter 24. Deep Sky, Mid-Realm. The dragon ship sliced through the pearly, dove-colored night, its wings gliding on the magic and the air currents that swept upward over the floating isle of Jern Hereva. Strapped into the flight harness, snug in the small steerage room, Hugh lit his pipe, leaned back, and relaxed, letting the dragon ship almost fly itself. A touch here or there upon the cables attached to the harness tilted the wings to slice through the air currents, sliding effortlessly across the sky from one swirl to another, gliding trackward toward Aristogon. The hand kept a lazy half-watch for other winged transports, either live or mechanical. In his elven ship, he was most vulnerable to attack from his own kind, for human dragon riders would immediately take him for an elf, probably a spy. Hugh was not particularly worried. He knew the flight paths the dragon riders took on their raids of Aristogon or elven shipping. He was flying higher purposefully to avoid these, and figured it unlikely that he'd be annoyed. If he did run into a patrol, he could always dodge it by slipping into a rift of clouds. The weather was calm, the flying easy, and Hugh had leisure to think. It was then that he decided not to kill the child. The need to make a decision had been in his mind a while now, but he had put off thinking about it until this time when he was alone and all around him was quiet and conducive to thought. He had never before defaulted on a contract, and he needed to satisfy himself that his reasoning was rational and valid and not swayed by sentiment. Sentiment. Though something within the hand might have sympathized with a childhood such as Bane's, a childhood unloved, cold, and bleak, the assassin had grown too callous to feel his own pain, much less that of another. He was letting the kid live for the very simple reason that Bane was going to be worth more to the hand alive than dead. Hugh did not have his plans quite worked out. He needed time to think, time to wring the truth from Alfred, time to unravel the mysteries that wound around the prince. The hand had a hideout on Aristogon, which he used when he needed his ship repaired. He would go there and wait until he had his information. Then he would either return and confront Stephen with his knowledge and demand more money to keep silent, or perhaps contact the Queen and discover what she would pay to have her son back. Whatever his decision, Hugh figured his fortune was made. He was settling into the rhythm of flying the craft, which he could do with his body and part of his mind, letting the other drift free, when the object of his thoughts poked his tow-head up through the hatch into the cabin. "Alfred sent some dinner." The boy's eyes were eager and curious, darting here and there at the cables attached to the harness, Hugh's arms resting easily on them. "Come up," Hugh invited. "Just be careful what you touch and where you step. Keep away from the ropes." Bane did as he was told, sliding up through the hatch, placing his foot gingerly on the deck. In his hands he carried a bowl of meat and vegetables. It was cold. Alfred had cooked it before they left Pitrin's exile, then packed it away to be eaten later. But it smelled good to a man accustomed to living on the wayfarer's meal of bread and cheese or the greasy fare of inns. "Hand it here." Hugh knocked the ashes from his pipe in a crockery mug he carried for this purpose, then held out his hands to take the bowl. Bane's eyes glistened. "You're supposed to be flying the ship." "She can fly herself," said Hugh, grasping the bowl and the horn spoon and shoveling the food into his mouth.
"But won't we fall?"
Bane peered out the crystal windows.
"The magic keeps us afloat, and even if it didn't, the wings could support us in this calm air. I just have to make certain they stay extended. If I pulled them in, then we'd begin to sink."
Bane nodded thoughtfully, turning his blue-eyed gaze back to Hugh.
"What cables draw them in?"
"These." He gestured to two heavy lengths of rope attached to the harness at his breast near his right and left shoulder. "I pull them this way in front of me, and that draws the wings in. These other cables let me steer by lifting the wings or lowering them. This one controls the mainmast, and this cable's attached to the tail. By flipping it one way or the other, I can control the ship's direction."
"So we could stay afloat like this for how long?"
Hugh shrugged. "Indefinitely, I suppose, or until we came to an isle. Then the wind currents would catch us and might suck us into a cliff or underneath the island, and slam us up against the coralite." Bane nodded gravely.
"I still think I could fly it."
Hugh felt satisfied enough with himself to smile indulgently.
"No, you're not strong enough."
The boy gazed at the harness in longing.
"Try it," Hugh invited. "Here, come stand beside me."
Bane did as he was told, moving cautiously, being careful not to accidentally jar one of the ropes. Standing on the deck in front of Hugh, the boy placed his hand on one of the ropes that caused the wing to rise or lower. He pulled at it. The rope moved slightly, enough to cause the wing to shiver, and that was all. Unaccustomed to having his will thwarted, the prince gritted his teeth, and wrapping both hands around the rope, pulled with all his might. The wooden frame creaked. The wing dipped a fraction of an inch. Grinning in triumph, Bane planted his feet on the deck and pulled even harder. A gust of wind sweeping upward caught the wing. The cable slid through his hands. The prince released his grip with a cry, staring at his palms, which were torn and bleeding. "Still think you can fly it?" the hand said coolly. Blinking back tears, Bane mumbled, "No, Sir Hugh," disconsolately. He wrapped his injured hand tightly around the feather amulet, as if seeking some sort of consolation. Perhaps it helped, for he swallowed and lifted shimmering blue eyes to meet Hugh's. "Thank you for letting me try."
"You did well enough, Your Highness," said Hugh. "I've seen men twice your size who didn't do as well."
"Truly?" The tears vanished. Hugh was rich now. He could afford the lie.
"Yeah. Now go on down and see if Alfred needs any help."
"I'll be back to get the bowl," Bane said, and ducked through the hatch. Hugh could hear his excited voice calling for Alfred, telling the Chamberlain how he had flown the dragon ship. Eating in silence, Hugh idly scanned the skies. He decided that the first thing he would do upon landing on Aristogon would be to take that feather to Kevam, the elven wizardess, and see what she could make of it. One of the lesser mysteries he had to solve, or so he thought at the time. 3 days passed. They flew by the night, hiding during the day on small, uncharted isles. It would take a week, Hugh said, to reach Aristogon. Bane came every night to sit with Hugh, watch him handle the ship, and ask questions. The hand answered or not, depending on his mood. Preoccupied with his plans and his flying, Hugh paid no more attention to Bane than he was forced to. Attachments were deadly in this world, bringing nothing but pain and sorrow. The boy was cold, hard cash, that was all. The hand was, however, puzzled at Alfred. The Chamberlain watched the prince nervously, anxiously. It might have been an overreaction to the tree's fall, but Alfred wasn't being protective. Hugh was strongly reminded of the time an elven fire canister had been hurled over a battlement of a castle he'd been caught in during a raid. Rolling about on the stone, the black metal container appeared harmless, but everyone knew that at any moment it could burst into flame. Men regarded that canister in exactly the same way Alfred was regarding Bane. Noting Alfred's tension, Hugh wondered, not for the first time, but the Chamberlain knew that he didn't. The assassin increased his own watchfulness over the boy when they were on the ground, thinking the child might try to run away. Bane meekly obeyed Hugh's command that he not leave the campsite unless escorted by Alfred, and then only to forage in the woods for the berries that he seemed to take such delight in finding. Hugh never went on these expeditions, considering them foolish. Left to himself to find food, he would have made do with whatever came to hand, so long as it kept life in his body. The Chamberlain insisted that His Highness have what he wanted, however, and each day the clumsy Alfred sallied forth into the forest to do battle with overhanging limbs, tangled vines, and treacherous weeds. Hugh stayed behind, resting in a half-wakeful, half-dozing state that allowed him to hear every snap and crash. The fourth night, Bane came up to the steerageway and stood staring up the crystal windows at the magnificent sights of cloud and vast empty sky below. "Alfred says dinner will be ready soon." Hugh, puffing on his pipe, grunted noncommittally. "What's that big shadow I can see out there?" Bane pointed.
"Aristogon."
"Is it? Will we be there soon?"
"No, it's farther away than it looks, another day or two."
"But where will we stay between here and there? I don't see any more islands."
"There are some, most likely hidden by the mists. Small isles, used by small ships like us for overnight stays."
Standing on tiptoe, Bane peered down beneath the dragon.
"I can see great dark clouds way, way below us, whirling round and round. That's the maelstrom, isn't it?"
Hugh saw no need to reply to the obvious. Bane stared more intently.
"Those two things down there, they look like dragons, but they're bigger than any dragon I ever saw."
Rising from his chair, careful not to disturb the cables, Hugh glanced out.
"Elven corsairs or waterships?"
"Elves."
The word was tense, eager. The boy's hand went to stroke the feather he wore around his neck. When he spoke next, it was with studied calm.
"Shouldn't we run away from them, then?"
"They're far from us, probably don't even see us. If they did, they'd think we were one of them. Besides, it looks like they've got business of their own to tend to."
The prince looked out again, saw two ships and nothing more. Hugh, however, could tell what was transpiring.
"Rebels trying to escape an Imperial warship."
Bane barely gave them a glance.
"I think I heard Alfred calling. It must be time for supper."
Hugh continued to watch the confrontation with interest. The warship had caught up with the rebels. Grappling hooks snaked out from the Imperial dragon ship and landed on the rebels' deck. It was to an attack similar to this made by humans that Hugh owed his escape from the slavery of the elven waterships. Several of the rebel elves, in an attempt to boost their level of magic and escape capture, were performing the dangerous maneuver known as walking the dragon wing. Hugh could see them running swiftly, sure-footedly, out on the wing's mast. In their hands, they carried charms given them by the ship's wizard that they would touch to the mast. The move was dangerous, foolhardy, and desperate. That far from the ship's center, the magical canopy could not reach them, could not protect them. A gust, or, as was happening now, an enemy arrow could catch them and carry them over the wing's edge to tumble down into the maelstrom. Walking the dragon wing. It had become a term among elves for any risk-taking adventure worth the prince. The saying had always, Hugh felt, held a special meaning for him and his way of life. He had named his ship in its honor. Bane returned with a bowl. "Where are the elves?" He handed the bowl to Hugh. "Back behind us. We've flown out beyond them." Hugh took a mouthful and choked, spitting it out.
"Damn! What did Alfred do, spill the pepper pot into this stuff?"
"I told him it was too spicy. Here, I brought you some wine."
The prince handed Hugh the wineskin. He took a deep drink, swallowed, and took another. Giving it back, he shoved over the bowl of uneaten food with his foot.
"Take that gunk back and feed it to Alfred."
Bane picked up the bowl, but he didn't leave the steerage way. Fingers toying with the feather, he stood watching Hugh with a strange, calm expectancy.
"What is it?" the hand snapped.
But at that very moment, he knew. He hadn't tasted the poison. The pepper had masked it. But he was feeling the first effects. Cramps clenched his bowels. A burning sensation spread through his body, and his tongue seemed to swell in his mouth. Objects in his sight elongated, then flattened. The boy grew huge, leaning over him with a sweet, charming smile, the feather dangling from his hand. Rage surged through Hugh, but not as swiftly or strongly as the poison. Sagging backward, his vision darkening, Hugh saw the feather and heard the boy's awed voice coming from a great distance.
"It worked, Father! He's dying!"
Hugh reached out to catch hold and choke the breath out of his murderer, but his arm was too heavy to lift. It hung limp and lifeless at his side. And then the boy was no longer standing over him, but a black monk with hand outstretched.
"And now, who is master?" asked the monk.
Chapter 25. Deep Sky, Mid-Realm. Hugh crashed to the deck, dragging the cables attached to the harness on his body with him. The ship listed sharply, slamming Bane backward into the bulkhead. The bowl of food fell from the child's hand with a clatter. From the cabin below, there was a resounding crash, followed by a pained and panicked yell. Staggering to his feet, clinging to the ship's side, the prince looked around dazedly. The deck slanted at a precarious angle. Hugh lay on his back, entangled in the cables. Bane glanced hastily outside, saw the nose of the dragon pointing straight down, and realized what had happened. Hugh's fall had pulled the wings in. The magic was not working. And now they were plunging out of control through the sky, plummeting down toward the maelstrom. It had not occurred to Bane that this would happen, nor had it apparently occurred to his father. That was not surprising. A human mysteriarch of the seventh house, living in realms far above the strife and turmoil of the rest of the world, could have no knowledge of things mechanical. Sinistrad had probably never even seen an elven dragon ship. And, after all, Hugh had assured the boy the ship could fly itself. Bane scrambled among the tangle of cables. Reaching Hugh's body, he pulled and tugged with all his might at the ropes, but he couldn't move them. The wings would not budge.
"Alfred!" the prince yelled. "Alfred, come quickly!"
There was another crash and a scuffling below. Then Alfred's face, deathly white, poked up through the hatch.
"Sir Hugh, what's happening? We're falling!"
His gaze rested on the man's body.
"Blessed Sartan!"
With a swiftness and ease unusual in such a clumsy, ungainly body, Alfred dashed in through the hatch, made his way over the coils of rope, and knelt beside Hugh.
"Oh, never mind him, he's dead," cried the prince.
Grabbing hold of Alfred's coat, he jerked him around to face the front of the ship.
"Look, you've got to stop us. Take the harness off him and fly this thing."
"Your Majesty,"
Alfred was livid.
"I can't fly a ship. It takes skill, years of practice."
The chamberlain's eyes narrowed.
"What do you mean, he's dead?"
Bane glared at him defiantly, but his gaze dropped before Alfred's. The chamberlain was no longer the buffoon. His eyes were suddenly, strangely compelling and intense, and the boy found their penetrating stare highly uncomfortable.
"He got what he deserved," Bane said sullenly. "He was an assassin hired by King Stephen to kill me. I have killed him first, that's all."
"You?"
Alfred's gaze went to the feather.
"Or your father?"
Bane looked confused. His lips opened, then clamped shut. His hand clenched around the amulet as if to hide it, and he began to stammer.
No need to lie, Alfred said, sighing. I've known for a long time, longer than your father and mother, or should I say your adopted father and mother, although adoption implies a choice, and they never had one. What kind of poison did you give him, Bane? Him? Why are you worried about him? Are you just going to let us crash?
The prince screeched shrilly.
He's the only one who can save us. What did you use on him?
Alfred demanded, reaching out his hand to grasp hold of the boy and shake the information out of him, if need be. The prince darted backwards, slipping and sliding across the slanting deck until he was brought to a halt by the bulkhead. Turning, he stared through the window. The prince let out a whoop.
The elven ships! We're heading straight for them! We don't need that filthy murderer! The elves will save us! No, wait, Bane, it was the berries, wasn't it?
The boy dashed out of the steerage way. Behind him, Bane heard Alfred shouting that elves were dangerous, but he paid no attention.
I'm Prince of Eulandia,
he said to himself, climbing the ladder to the top deck. There, clinging with his hands to the rails, he entwined his legs through them to hold on securely.
They won't dare lay a hand on me. I've still got the enchantment.
Tryon thinks he broke it, but that's only because it was what I wanted him to think.
Father says we mustn't take a chance, and so we had to kill the assassin to get his ship. But I know the enchantment's still with me. Now I'll have an elf ship. I'll make them fly me to my father, and he and I will rule them. We'll rule them all, just as we planned.
Hey! Bane shouted. Holding onto the rail with his legs, he let loose long enough to wave his arms.
Hey there! Help! Help us!
The elves were far below, too far away to hear the boy's cry. Besides, they had other more important things on their minds, such as staying alive. Looking down from his perch, Bane could see the rebel ship and the Imperial warship locked together, and he wondered what was going on. He was too high to see the blood spilling over the deck. He could not hear the screams of the cable haulers, trapped in their harnesses, being dragged through the splintered hulls, nor could he hear the song of the rebel elves who attempted, even as they defended themselves, to turn the hearts of their brothers. Bright-colored dragon wings beat the air frantically or swung broken from snapped cables. Long grappling hooks attached to ropes held one ship firmly to the other. Elven warriors swung hand over hand along the cables to board the ship or leapt through the air to land on the deck. Far beneath them, the maelstrom swirled and boiled, its black clouds with frothy white fringes lit purple by the incessantly flaring lightning. Bane stared down at the elves eagerly. He felt no fear, only a heady exhilaration caused by the rushing of the wind in his face, the novelty of his situation, and the excitement of his father's plans coming to fulfillment. The dragon ship's fall had slowed somewhat. Alfred had managed to pull the wings out far enough so that the ship was no longer tumbling headfirst into the maelstrom. But it was out of control and falling still, drifting downward in a lazy spiral. Alfred's voice came to him from below. It was indistinct. He couldn't understand the man's words. Yet something about the tone or the rhythm brought back to his mind the hazy memory of when the tree had crashed down on top of him. Bane didn't pay much attention to it. They were nearing the elves, coming closer by the moment. He could see faces upturned, looking at him and pointing. He started to shout again when suddenly both the elven ships broke apart, disintegrating before his eyes. Slender figures toppled into the nothingness around them, and Bane was close enough now to hear the screams that would end when they were swallowed up in the maelstrom. Here and there, fragments of the two ships, held aloft by their own enchantment, floated in the air, and he could see elves clinging to them, or on the larger pieces, some still battling. And Bane and his small ship were plunging down right into the center of the chaos. Kyr monks do not laugh. They see nothing funny in life, and like to point out that when humans laugh, it is often at the misfortune of others. Laughing is not prohibited in a Kyr monastery, it simply isn't done. A child, when first taken into the halls of the black monks, may laugh for a day or two, but not longer. The black monk holding Hugh by the hand did not smile, but Hugh saw laughter in the eyes. Furious, he fought and struggled more fiercely against this one opponent than he had fought against any in his life. This opponent was not flesh and blood. No wound left its mark on it. No jab slowed it down. It was eternal, and it held him fast.
You hated us, said the black monk, laughing at him soundlessly. Yet you served us. All your life you served us.
I serve no man, shouted Hugh.
His struggles were lessening. He was growing weak, tired. He wanted to rest. Only shame and anger kept him from slipping into welcome oblivion. Shame because he knew the monk was right. Anger that he had so long been their dupe. Bitter, frustrated, he summoned all his waning strength and made one final attempt to free himself. It was a weak and pitiful blow that wouldn't have made tears come to the eyes of a child. but the monk let loose. Astounded, bereft of the support, Hugh fell. There was no terror in his heart, for he had the strangest impression that he was not falling down, but up. He was not plunging into darkness. He was plunging into light.
Sir Hugh?
Alfred's face, fearful and anxious, floated above him.
Sir Hugh? Oh, praise the sun, you're all right. How do you feel, sir?
With Alfred's help, Hugh sat up. He glanced swiftly around him, searching for the monk. He saw no one other than the chamberlain, nothing except a tangle of ropes and his harness.
What happened?
Hugh shook his head to clear it. He felt no pain, only a kind of grogginess. His brain seemed too large for his skull, his tongue too big for his mouth. He'd awakened in an inn on occasion with exactly this same feeling, an empty wineskin at his side.
The boy drugged you. It's wearing off now. I know you're not feeling too well, Sir Hugh, but we're in trouble. The ship is falling.
Drugged?
Hugh looked at Alfred, trying to bring him into focus through the fog.
He didn't drug me. It was poison.
His eyes narrowed.
I was dying.
No, no, Sir Hugh. I know it might feel that way, but...
Hugh leaned forward. Catching hold of Alfred by the collar, he dragged the man near him, staring into the light-colored eyes in an effort to see into his very soul.
I was dead.
Hugh tightened his grip.
You brought me back to life.
Alfred returned Hugh's gaze calmly. He smiled somewhat sadly and shook his head.
You are mistaken. It was a drug. I have done nothing.
Bumbling, oafish, how could this man lie and Hugh not know it? More important, how could Alfred have saved his life? The face was guileless. The eyes looked at him with pity and sadness, nothing more. Alfred seemed incapable of hiding anything. Had Hugh been anyone else, he must have believed him. But the assassin knew that poison. He had given it to others. He had seen them die as he had. None of them had ever come back.
Sir Hugh, the ship, Alfred persisted. We're falling. The wings pulled inward. I tried, but I couldn't get them out again.
Now that his attention was called to it, Hugh could feel the ship rolling. He stared at Alfred, then let loose his grip on the man. Another mystery, but it wouldn't be solved by tumbling into the maelstrom. Hugh staggered to his feet, his hands clutching his pounding head. It was too heavy. He had the dazed feeling that if he let go, his skull might snap loose and roll off his neck. A glance out the window showed him that they were in no immediate danger, at least not from falling. Alfred had managed to bring the ship into some semblance of control, and Hugh could regain it completely easily enough, despite the fact that some of the cables had snapped.
Falling into the maelstrom's the least of our worries.
What do you mean, sir?
Alfred hurried to his side and looked out. Gazing up at them so near that they could see every detail of their torn and bloodied clothing were three elven warriors, grappling hooks in their hands.
Here, toss them up. I'll make them fast.
It was Bane's voice coming from the deck above.
Alfred gasped. His Majesty said something about seeking help from the elves.
Help?
Hugh's lips twisted into a mocking grin. It seemed he had come back to life only to die again. The grappling hooks snaked through the air. He heard the thuds when they landed on the deck, the scraping sound of the iron claws sliding over the wood. There was a tug and a jerk that knocked him, unsteady as he was, off his feet. The hooks had caught hold. He put his hand to his side. His sword was gone.
Where?
Alfred had seen his gesture and was slipping and sliding across the unsteady deck.
Here, sir, I had to use it to cut you free.
Hugh grabbed hold of the weapon and nearly dropped it. If Alfred had handed him an anvil, it could have seemed no heavier than his sword in his weak and shaking hand. The hooks were dragging the ship to a stop, keeping it floating in the air next to the disabled elven vessel. There was a sharp pull, and the ship sagged downward. The elves were scaling the ropes, coming aboard. Up above, Hugh could hear Bane chattering excitedly. Gripping the sword, Hugh left the steerage way, padded soft-footed into the corridor to stand beneath the hatch. Alfred stumbled behind, the man's loud, clumsy footfalls making Hugh cringe. He cast the chamberlain a baleful glance, warning him to be silent. Then, slipping his dagger from the top of his boot, the assassin held it out. Alfred blenched, shook his head, and put his hands behind his back.
No, he said through trembling lips. I can't take a life.
Hugh looked up above, where booted feet could be heard walking across the deck.
Not even to save your own,
he hissed. Alfred lowered his eyes.
I'm sorry.
If you're not now, you're soon going to be, muttered Hugh, and began to silently climb the ladder.
Chapter 26. Deep Sky, Descending. Bane watched the three elves propel themselves hand over hand across the ropes, their thin, shapely legs grasping it with heels and knees. Beneath them was nothing but empty air, and far below, the dark and awesome, perpetually raging storm. The elves were expert at boarding, however, and did not pause or look down. Reaching the deck of the small dragon ship, they swung their legs over the sides and landed lightly on their feet. Having never seen elves before, the prince studied them as intently as they were ignoring him. The elves were nearly the same height as average humans, but their slender bodies made them appear taller. Their features were delicate, yet hard and cold, as if they had been carved out of marble. Smooth-muscled, they were extremely well-coordinated and walked with ease and grace, even on the listing ship. Their skin was nut-brown, their hair and eyebrows white, tinted with silver that glistened in the sun. They wore what appeared to be vests and short skirts made like finely stitched tapestries, decorated with fanciful pictures of birds and flowers and animals. Humans often made fun of the elves' bright-colored garb, to their regret, most discovering too late that it was in reality elven armor. Elven wizards possess the power to magically enhance ordinary silken thread, making it as hard and tough as steel. The elf who appeared to be the leader motioned the other two to look around the ship. One ran aft, staring over the side at the wings, possibly to assess the damage that had caused this ship to tumble out of control. The other ran back to the stern. The elves were armed, but they didn't carry their weapons in hand. They were, after all, on a ship made by their own kind. Seeing his men deployed, the elven commander finally deigned to notice the child.
"What is a human brat doing on board a ship of my people?"
The commander stared down his long, aquiline nose at the boy.
"And where is the captain of this vessel?"
He spoke human well, but with a twist to his mouth, as if the words tasted bad and he was glad to be rid of them. His voice was lilting and musical, his tone imperious and condescending. Bane was angry, but knew how to hide it.
"I am Crown Prince of Volcaron and Eulandia. King Stephen is my father."
Bane thought it best to begin this way, at least until he had the elves convinced that he was someone important. Then he would tell them the truth, tell them that he was of truly great importance, greater than they could imagine. The elf captain was keeping one eye on his men, giving Bane half his attention.
"So my people have captured a human princeling, have they? I don't know what they think they'll get for you."
"An evil man captured me," Bane said, tears coming readily to his eyes. "He was going to murder me. But you've rescued me. You'll be heroes. Take me to your king that I may extend my thanks. This could be the beginning of the peace between our people."
The elf who had been inspecting the wings returned, his report on his lips. Overhearing the boy's speech, he looked at his captain. Both laughed simultaneously. Bane sucked in his breath. Never in his life had anyone laughed at him. What was happening? The enchantment should be working. He was positive Tryon hadn't been able to break the spell. Why wasn't his enchantment working on the elves? And then Bane saw the talismans. Worn around the elves' necks, the talismans were created by the elven wizards to protect their people against human war magic. Bane didn't understand this, but he knew a warding talisman when he saw it, and knew that inadvertently it was shielding the elves from the enchantment. Before he could react, the captain grabbed hold of him and tossed him through the air like a bag of garbage. He was caught by the other elf, whose strength belied the slender body. The elf captain gave a careless command, and the elf, holding the boy at arm's length as if he were a skunk, walked over to the ship's rail. Bane did not speak elven, but he understood the command given by the elf captain's gesture. He was to be tossed overboard. Bane tried to scream, fear choked off his breath. He fought and struggled. The elf held him by the scruff of the neck and seemed to be highly amused at the child's frantic efforts to free himself. Bane possessed the power of magic, but he was untrained, not having been brought up in his father's house. He could feel magic run through him like adrenaline. He lacked the knowledge to make it work. There was someone who could tell him, however. Bane grasped hold of the feather amulet.
"Father, he can't help you now," laughed the elf.
"Father," Bane cried again.
"I was right," said the elf captain to his cohort. "There is someone else aboard, the brat's father. Go search."
He gestured to the third elf, who came running back from the stern.
"Go ahead, get rid of the little bastard," the captain grunted.
The elf holding Bane held the boy over the rail and then dropped him. Bane tumbled through the air. He sucked in his breath to let it out in a howl of terror, when a voice commanded him abruptly to be silent. The voice came as it always did to the child, speaking words that he heard in his mind, words audible only to himself.
"You have the ability to save yourself, Bane, but first you must conquer fear."
Falling rapidly, seeing below him floating pieces of debris from the elven ship, and below that the black clouds of the maelstrom, Bane went stiff and rigid with fright.
I can't, Father," he whimpered.
"If you can't, then you will die, which will be all to the best. I have no use for a son who is a coward."
All his short life, Bane had striven to please the man who spoke to him through the amulet, the man who was his true father. To win the powerful wizard's approval was his dearest wish.
"Shut your eyes,"
was Sinistrad's next command. Bane did so. Now we are going to work the magic. Think to yourself that you are lighter than the air. Your body is not solid flesh, but airy, buoyant. Your bones are hollow, like a bird's. The prince wanted to laugh, but something inside told him if he did so, he would never be able to control it and would drop to his death. Swallowing the wild, hysterical giggling, he tried to do as his father commanded. It seemed ludicrous. His eyes wouldn't stay shut, but kept flying open to watch in panic-stricken desperation for a bit of debris to cling to until he could be rescued. The wind rushing past made his eyes tear, however, and he couldn't see clearly. A sob welled up in his throat. "Bane!" Sinistrad's voice flicked through the child's mind like a whip. Gulping, Bane squinched his eyes tightly shut and tried to picture himself a bird. At first it was difficult and seemed impossible. Generations of wizards long dead, plus the boy's own inherent skill and intelligence, came to Bane's aid. The trick was to banish reality, to convince the mind that its body did not weigh 60-some rock, that it weighed nothing or less than nothing. It was a skill most young human wizards must study years to attain, yet Bane was having to learn it in seconds. Mother birds teach the young to fly by tossing them out of the nest. Bane was acquiring the art of magic in the same way. Shock and sheer terror jolted his natural talent into taking over and saving him. "My flesh is made of cloud, my blood is fine mist, my bones are hollow and filled with air." A tingling sensation spread through the prince's body. It seemed as if the magic was changing him into a cloud, for he felt weightless and airy. As this feeling increased, so did his confidence in the illusion he was spinning around himself. And the magic in turn increased, growing stronger and more powerful. Opening his eyes, Bane saw to his delight that he was no longer falling. Lighter than a snowflake, he was drifting in the sky. "I've done it, I've done it!" He laughed gleefully, flapping his arms like a bird. "Concentrate," Sinistrad snapped. "This is not play. Break the concentration and you lose the power." Bane sobered. His father's words had not affected him so much as the sudden, frightening sensation he'd experienced of growing heavier again. Resolutely, he set his mind to its task of keeping him afloat among the wispy clouds.
"What do I do now, father?"
he asked, more subdued.
"Remain where you are for the moment. The elves will rescue you."
"But they tried to kill me."
"Yes, but now they will see that you possess the power, and they will want to take you to their wizards. That will lead you to their court. You may as well spend some time there before you return to me. You might gather useful information." Bane gazed upward, trying to see what was happening on the ship. All that was visible to him from his angle was the underside of the hull and the half-spread wings. The dragon ship was still falling, however. Bane relaxed, floating in the air, and waited for it to come to him. Chapter 27. Deep Sky Descending. Hugh and Alfred crouched at the foot of the stairs. They could hear the elves searching the ship. They heard the elf captain's conversation with Bane.
"Little bastard," Hugh muttered beneath his breath.
Then they heard Bane scream. Alfred paled.
"You want him, you better help rescue him," Hugh said to the Chamberlain. "Keep close behind me."
Clambering up the ladder, Hugh threw open the hatch. Sword in hand, he surged out onto the deck with Alfred right behind him. The first thing he saw was the elf hurling Bane over the side of the ship. Alfred cried out in horror.
"Never mind,"
shouted Hugh, looking about swiftly for something to use as a weapon.
"Cover my back." "By the ancestors, no you don't."
Alfred's eyes were rolling up into his head. His face was ashen as he swayed on his feet. Hugh reached out a hand, grabbed him to shake him furiously, but it was too late. The Chamberlain keeled over and landed on the deck in a pathetic heap.
"Damn!"
Hugh swore viciously. The elves were stiff and weary from their fight with the rebels. They had not expected to find humans on board a dragon ship, and they were slow to react. Hugh grabbed for the spar just as one of the elf fighters attempted to reach it first. The hand was quicker. Lifting it, he snatched it up with all the force he could manage and thwacked the elf across the face. The fighter toppled, striking his head against the hatch when he fell. Presumably, he would be out for a while. Hugh dared not finish him off, for he had two other elves in front of him. Elves are not particularly skilled swordsmen. They prefer the bow and arrow, which demonstrates skill and judgment, not merely brute strength, all they consider swordplay. The short blades elves carry at their sides are generally used for close fighting or to dispatch victims already wounded by arrows. Knowing the elves' dislike for the blade, Hugh swung his sword wildly, forcing them to keep out of his reach. He edged backward, hopping from plank to plank, until he ran into the bulwarks, the elves pressing him, but not moving into attack. Not yet. Whatever they lack in technique, elves make up for in patience and wariness. It was taking all Hugh's waning strength just to keep the blade in his hand. The elves could see that he was sick and weak. Fainting, jabbing, they drained his energy. They could afford to wait until weariness forced him to drop his guard. Hugh's arms ached, his head throbbed. He knew that he could not hold out long. Somehow this must end. Movement caught his eye.
"Alfred!"
Hugh bellowed.
"That's it! Take them from behind!"
It was an old trick, and no human fighter worth his codpiece would have fallen for it. As it was, the elven captain kept his eyes fixed on Hugh, but the other warrior lost his nerve and turned his head. What he saw was not a menacing human bearing down at him, but Alfred sitting up and looking about him dazedly. Hugh was on the elf in a flash, slashing the sword out of his hand and bashing the warrior in the face with his fist. This move left him open to attack from the captain, but he couldn't help that. The elf captain leapt forward to strike. His feet slipped on the slanting deck. The clumsy stroke missed Hugh's heart and tore through the muscles of his sword arm. Hugh spun on his heel, caught the captain across the jaw with the hilt of the blade, and sent the elf sprawling on his back on the deck, his weapon flying from his hand. Hugh sank to his knees, fighting dizziness and nausea.
"Sir Hugh, you're injured. Let me help."
Hands touched his arm, but Hugh jerked away.
"I'm all right," he snapped.
Staggering to his feet, he glared at the Chamberlain, who flushed and hung his head.
I'm sorry I let you down," he stammered. "I don't know what comes over me."
Hugh cut him off, gesturing at the elves.
"Toss this scum overboard before they come to."
Alfred went so pale that Hugh thought he was going to faint again.
"I can't do that, sir. Throw a helpless man to his death."
"They threw that kid of yours to his death."
Hugh raised his sword, holding it above the neck of the unconscious elf.
"Then I'll have to get rid of them here. I can't take a chance on them coming around."
He started to cut the slender neck, but a strange reluctance halted him. A voice came to him from out of a vast and horrifying darkness.
"All your life you served us."
"Please, sir,"
Alfred caught hold of his arm.
"Their ship is still attached to ours."
He pointed to where the remnants of the elven vessel nosed alongside the dragon ship, the grappling hooks holding it fast.
"I could transfer them back there. At least they'd have a chance of being rescued."
"Very well."
Too sick and tired to argue, Hugh gave in with an ill grace.
"Do what you want, just get rid of them. What do you care about elves anyway? They murdered your precious prince."
"All life is sacred,"
said Alfred softly, leaning down to lift the unconscious elf captain by the shoulders.
"We learned that too late, too late."
At least that's what Hugh thought he said. The wind was whistling through the rigging. He was sick and in pain, and who cared anyway? Alfred performed the task in his usual bumbling fashion, tripping over the planks, dropping the bodies, once nearly hanging himself when he became entangled in one of the wing cables. Eventually, he managed to haul the unconscious elves to the ship's rail and heave them onto their own ship with a strength the hand found difficult to credit in the tall, gangling man. But then, there was a lot about Alfred that was inexplicable. Was I really dead? Did Alfred bring me back to life? And if so, how? Not even the Mysteriarchs have the ability to restore the dead.
All life is sacred. Too late, too late.
Hugh shook his head and was immediately sorry. He thought his eyeballs must burst out of their sockets. Alfred returned to find Hugh trying to knot a clumsy bandage around his arm.
"Sir Hugh,"
Alfred began timidly. Hugh did not look up from his work. Gently, the Chamberlain took over, tying the bandage deftly.
"I think you should come and see something, sir."
"I know we're still falling, but I can pull us out. How close are we to the maelstrom?"
"It's not just that, sir. It's the prince. He's safe."
"Safe?"
Hugh stared at him, thinking the man had gone mad.
"It's very peculiar, sir, although not so peculiar, I suppose, considering who he is and who his father is."
"Who the hell is he?" Hugh wanted to ask, but now was not the time. Sick and hurting, he made his way across the deck, whose movements were becoming more and more erratic as they drew nearer the storm. Looking down below, he could not repress a low whistle of amazement.
"His father is a Mysteriarch of the High Realm," said Alfred. "I suppose he taught the boy to do that."
"They communicate through the amulet," said the hand,
recalling his failing vision, focusing on the boy clasping the feather in his hand.
"Yes."
Hugh could see the boy's upturned face, looking at them triumphantly, evidently quite pleased with himself.
"I'm supposed to rescue him, I suppose. A kid who tried to poison me. A kid who wrecked my ship. A kid who tried to turn us all over to the elves."
"After all, sir," replied Alfred, gazing at Hugh steadily, "you did agree to murder him for money."
Hugh glanced back down at Bane. They were nearing the maelstrom. He could see the stinging clouds of dust and debris floating above it, and hear the dull booming of the thunder. A cool, moist wind smelling of rain was causing the tail rudder to flap wildly. Right now, Hugh should be examining the snapped cables, trying to rig them so that he could extend the wings and regain the upper air before the ship drifted too close, before the winds of the storm could prevent them from rising, and the pounding in his head was making him sick. Turning, Hugh left the rail.
"I don't blame you," said Alfred. "He is a difficult child."
"Difficult?"
Hugh laughed, then paused, eyes closed, as the deck cantered away beneath his feet. When he was himself again, he drew a deep breath.
"Take that spar and hold it out to him. I'll try to maneuver the ship closer. We're risking our own lives doing this. Chances are we'll get caught by the winds and sucked into the storm."
"Yes, Sir Hugh."
Alfred ran to get the spar, for once his feet and his body all going the same direction. The hand dropped through the hatch into the steerageway and stood staring at the mess. "Why am I doing this?" he asked himself. "It's simple," was the response. "You've got a father who will pay to have his son not come back, and another father who will pay to get hold of the kid." "That makes sense," Hugh admitted. "All, of course, provided we don't wind up in the maelstrom." Looking out the crystal window, he could see the boy floating among the clouds. The dragon ship was falling down to meet him. But unless Hugh could alter their course, they would miss him by over a wing's length. Gloomily, the hand surveyed the wreckage, prodding his aching mind to function and delineate between the various ropes that were twisting and slithering across the deck like snakes. Finding those he needed, he untangled them and laid them out straight so that they could run easily through the hawse holes. Once the cables were arranged, he cut them loose from the harness with his sword and wound them around his arms. He had seen men suffer broken bones from doing this. If he lost control, the heavy wing would fly out suddenly, jerk the rope, and snap his arms like a twig. Seating himself, his feet braced against the deck, Hugh began to pay out the line slowly. One length of cable ran swiftly and smoothly through the hawse hole. The wing began to lift and the magic to activate. But the cable on Hugh's right arm remained limp and lifeless, straggling across the deck. He wiped sweat from his brow with the back of his hand. The wing was stuck, jammed. Hugh hauled back on the cable with all his might, hoping to jolt it free. It did no good, and he realized that one of the exterior cables attached to his guide rope must have snapped. Swearing to himself beneath his breath, the hand abandoned the broken cable and concentrated on flying the ship with one wing.
"Nearer!" Alfred shouted. "A little more to the left! Or is that starboard? I can never remember. Port? Perhaps port! There, I've almost got him! Now, hang on tightly, Your Highness!"
Hugh heard the prince's shrill voice yammering excitedly about something, the sound of small boots hitting the deck. Then he heard Alfred's voice, low and rebuking, and Bane's defensive whine. Hugh pulled back on the cable, felt the wing lift, and the dragon ship, aided by its magic, began to float upward. The clouds of the maelstrom swirled below, seemingly angry to see the prey escaping. Hugh held his breath, concentrating all his energy on holding the wings steady as they continued slowly rising. It was as if a giant hand reached out to slap them like an irritating mosquito. The ship dropped suddenly and sickeningly, plunging downward so fast that it seemed their bodies went with it, but their stomachs and bowels stayed up above. Hugh heard a frightened shriek and a heavy bump, and knew someone must have been thrown to the deck. The hand hoped both Alfred and the kid had found something to hang on to, but there was nothing he could do about it if they hadn't. Grimly, he held onto the cables, fighting to keep the wing up to slow their descent. Then he heard an ominous ripping sound and the eerie whistle that stops the hearts of all dragon ship pilots. The wing had torn. The wind was rushing through it. Hugh paid out the line as far as it would go, opening the wing all the way. Although he couldn't use it to steer, at least its magic would help cushion their fall when they hit the ground, if they hit the ground, and if the maelstrom didn't rip them apart first. Unwinding the rope from around his arm, Hugh threw it onto the deck. They hadn't reached the maelstrom yet, and already the wind was whipping the ship around. He couldn't stand up and was forced to crawl across the planking, clinging to the cables and using them to pull himself into the corridor. Once there, he dragged himself up the ladder and peered out. Alfred and Bane were lying flat on the top deck, the Chamberlain with his arm wrapped tightly around the boy.
"Down here!"
Hugh yelled above the buffeting of the wind.
"The wings split! We're sinking into the storm!"
Alfred slithered on his stomach across the deck, hauling Bane with him. Hugh took a certain grim pleasure in noting that the child appeared to be stricken dumb with terror. Reaching the hatch, the Chamberlain shoved the prince ahead of him. Hugh grasped hold of the boy none too gently, pulled him inside, and dropped him onto the deck. Bane let out a howl of pain that was cut short when the ship flipped over, slamming him into the bulwarks and knocking the breath from his body. The motion sent Alfred plunging through the hatch headfirst, causing Hugh to lose his footing. He crashed down the ladder onto the deck below. The hand staggered to his feet and made his way back up the ladder, or perhaps it was down the ladder. The ship was rolling over and over, and he had lost all sense of direction. He grabbed hold of the hatch cover. A rain squall hit the ship,
water lashed down with the force of elven spears. A jagged bolt of lightning split the air near enough that the smell made him wrinkle his nose. The concussion of the air rushing back together nearly deafened him. He fumbled at the hatch cover. It was slippery and wet, and finally managed to yank it shut. Wearily, he slid back down the ladder and collapsed onto the deck.
You're alive!
Bane stared at him in blank astonishment. Then his expression changed to one of joy. Running over to Hugh, the child threw his arms around him and hugged him close.
Oh, I'm so glad. I was so frightened. You saved my life.
Detaching the clinging hands, Hugh held the prince at arm's length. There was no doubting the sincerity either in the tear-choked voice or on the innocent face. There was no guile or deceit in the blue eyes. The hand could have almost imagined that he had dreamed everything. Almost, but not quite. This Bane, so aptly named, had tried to poison him. Hugh put his hand around the boy's white throat. It would be a simple matter. One twist, snap the neck, contract fulfilled. The ship pitched and tossed in the storm. The hull creaked and groaned and seemed likely to fly apart at any moment. Lightning flashed around them. Thunder boomed in their ears. All your life you served us. Hugh tightened his grasp. Bane gazed up at him. The child was trusting, shyly smiling. The assassin might have been soothing the prince with a loving caress. Angrily, the hand hurled the boy away from him, sent him stumbling into Alfred, who caught him reflexively. Stumbling past the two, heading for the steerage way, Hugh dropped to his hands and knees and heaved up his guts. Chapter 28. Drevlin, Low Realm. Bane was the first to regain consciousness, opening his eyes. He stared around at his surroundings, at the dragon ship and its other two occupants. He could hear a low rumble of thunder, and for a moment his terror returned. Then he realized the storm was some distance away. Looking outside, he could see it was calm, with only a spatter of rain hitting the ship. The horrid motion had ended. Everything was still. Nothing moved. Hugh lay on the deck amidst the cables, his eyes closed, blood on his head and arm, his hand hanging on to one of the ropes, as though his last effort had been to make some attempt to save them. Alfred lay sprawled on his back. The Chamberlain did not appear to be injured. Bane remembered little about the terrifying descent through the storm, but he had the impression from somewhere that Alfred had fainted. Bane, too, had been afraid, more afraid even than when the elf captain had tossed him over the side of the ship. That had happened swiftly, so there had been only a short time for fear. The fall into the storm had seemed to take forever, with terror growing stronger every second. Bane had really thought he might die of it. He recalled then his father's voice whispering words that lulled him into sleep. The prince attempted to sit up. He felt peculiar, not hurt, just peculiar. His body seemed too heavy, a tremendous force was weighing him down, yet there was nothing on top of him. Bane whimpered a little in fright, and at the feeling of being alone. He didn't like these strange sensations, and he crawled over to shake Alfred to try to wake him. Then Bane saw Hugh's sword lying on the deck beneath him, and the child had a thought.
I could kill them both now, he said, gripping the feather amulet tightly. We could be rid of them, father.
No! The word was stern and sharp and startled him.
Why not?
Because you need them to get you away from this place and bring you to me. But first there is a task I want you to perform. You have landed on the Isle of Drevlin in the Low Realm. A people known as Geggs inhabit this land. Actually, I am quite pleased that chance has brought you here. I was planning to come myself when I acquired a ship. There is a great machine on this isle that very much intrigues me. It was built long ago by the Sartan, but for what purpose no one has ever been able to discover. I want you to investigate it while you are there. Do this and find out what you can about these Geggs. Though I doubt if they can be of much use to me in my conquest of the world, it is wise to know as much as I can about those I intend to conquer. I might even be able to make use of them. You must watch my son for the opportunity.
The voice faded. Bane scowled. If only Sinistrad would stop his irritating habit of saying, when I conquer, when I rule. It was to be we. Bane had determined this.
Of course, my father can't know much about me yet. That's why he's never included me in his plans. When we meet, he'll get to know me. He'll be proud of me, and he'll be glad to share his power with me. He'll teach me all his magic. We'll do everything together. I won't be lonely anymore.
Hugh began to groan and stir. Bane hurriedly lay back down on the deck and shut his eyes. Hugh eased himself up painfully, propping his body with his arms. His first thought was one of absolute astonishment to discover he was alive. His next was that he would pay that elven wizard who cast the spell on his ship double what he charged for magic and feel that it was cheap.
His next was for his pipe. Reaching into the soiled and sodden velvet tunic, Hugh discovered it safe, unbroken. The hand glanced at his companions. Alfred was out cold. Hugh had never in his life known anyone to pass out from sheer terror. Marvelous person to have around in a crisis. The boy was also unconscious, but he was breathing steadily. His color was good. He hadn't been hurt. Hugh's future security was alive and well. "But first," muttered the hand, edging across the deck to the boy, "we need to get rid of Daddy, if that's who this really is." Moving slowly and cautiously, careful not to wake the child, Hugh slid his fingers beneath the silver chain from which the feather amulet was suspended and started to lift it from around the boy's neck. The chain slid through his fingers. Hugh stared at it incredulously. The chain had not slipped off his fingers, but through them, literally. He had seen it pass right through solid flesh and bone with as much ease as if his hand had been as insubstantial as that of a ghost's. "I'm imagining things. The bump on the head," he said, and grasped the chain, this time firmly. He held nothing in his hand but air. Hugh realized then that Bane's eyes had opened. The boy was watching him, not angrily or suspiciously, but with sadness.
"It won't come off," he said. "I've tried."
The prince sat up.
"What happened? Where are we?"
"We're safe," Hugh said, sitting back and drawing forth his pipe. He'd smoked the last of the Sterigo, not that he had any way to light it, even if he hadn't. He clamped the stem in his teeth and sucked on the empty bowl.
"You saved our lives," Bane told him. "And after I tried to kill you, I'm sorry. I truly am."
The limpid blue eyes lifted to gaze at Hugh.
"It was only that I was afraid of you."
Hugh sucked on the pipe and said nothing.
"I feel so strange,"
continued the prince in easy conversation, that one small matter between them having now finally been cleared up.
"Like I'm too heavy for my body."
"It's the pressure down here, the weight of the air. You'll get used to it. Just sit still and don't move." Bane sat, fidgeting. His gaze went to Hugh's sword.
"You're a warrior. You can defend yourself the honorable way. But I'm weak. What else could I do? You are an assassin, aren't you? You were hired to kill me."
"And you're not Stephen's son," Hugh countered.
"No, sir, he is not."
The voice was Alfred's. The Chamberlain sat up, looking around him in confusion.
"Where are we?"
"My guess is we're in the Low Realm. With luck, we're on Drevlin."
"Why luck?"
"Because Drevlin's the only continent down here that's inhabited. The Geggs will help us if we can make it to one of their cities. This Low Realm is swept constantly by terrible storms," he added in explanation. "If we're caught in one out in the open..." Hugh finished his sentence with a shrug. Alfred blanched and cast a worried glance outside. Bane squirmed and twisted to see.
"It's not storming now. Shouldn't we leave?"
"Wait until your body's gotten used to the change in pressure. We'll need to move fast when we go."
"And you think we're on this Drevlin?"
Alfred asked. "Judging from our location when he fell, I'd say so. We were blown around some by the storm, but Drevlin's the largest landmass down here, and it'd be hard to miss. If we'd been blown off course too far, we wouldn't be anywhere."
"You've been here before."
Bane sat up straight, staring at Hugh.
"Yes." "What's it like?"
he questioned eagerly. Hugh did not immediately reply. His eyes shifted to Alfred, who had lifted his hand and was examining it in puzzlement, as if certain it must belong to someone else.
"Go outside and see for yourself, Your Highness."
"You mean it?"
Bane scrambled to his feet.
"I can go outside?"
"See if you can find any signs of a Geg settlement. There's a big machine on this continent. If you can see parts of it, there'll be Gegs living nearby. Keep close to the ship. You get caught by a storm with nowhere to go for shelter, and you're finished."
"Is that wise, sir?"
Alfred looked anxiously after the boy, who was squeezing his small body out of a hole smashed in the hull.
"He won't go far. He'll get tired sooner than he realizes. Now, while he's gone, tell me the truth."
Alfred became very pale. Shifting uncomfortably, he lowered his eyes and stared at his two large hands.
"You were right, sir, when you said that Bane was not Stephen's child. I will tell you what I know, what any of us knows for certain as far as that goes, although I believe Tryon has conjectured some theories to explain what happened. I must say that they didn't seem to completely cover all the circumstances."
He saw Hugh's face darken, the brows draw together with impatience. 10 cycles ago, a child was born to Stephen and Anne. It was a boy, a beautiful baby, with his father's dark hair and his mother's eyes and ears. You think that is odd that I mentioned the ears, but it will become important later on.
Anne, you see, has a nick in her left ear, right here, at the outer curve. It is a trait in her family. The story goes that long ago, when the Sartans still walked the world, one of their kind was saved from harm when a spear thrown at him was deflected by Anne's ancestor. The point sliced off a part of the man's left ear. All children born since have been marked with that notch as a symbol of the family's honor. Anne's child had the notch. I saw it myself when they brought the babe out for the showing. Alfred's voice lowered. The child found in the cradle the next morning did not. A changeling, commented Hugh. Surely they knew. Yes, they knew. We all knew. The baby appeared to be the same age as the prince, only a day or two old. But this baby was fair-haired with bright blue eyes, not the milky kind of blue that will turn brown. And the child's ears were both perfectly shaped. We questioned everyone in the palace, but no one knew how the switch was made. The guards swore no one had slipped past them. They were good men. Stephen did not doubt their word. The nurse slept in the room with the baby all night and woke to take him to the wet nurse, who said that she put to her breast Anne's dark-haired boy. By this and by other tokens, Tryon judged that the child had been placed there by magic. Other tokens? Alfred sighed, his gaze strayed outside. Bane was standing on a rock, peering intently into the distance. On the horizon, black clouds flecked with lightning were massing. The wind was beginning to rise. The baby had a powerful enchantment woven round him. Anyone who looked at him must immediately love him. No, love isn't the right word. The chamberlain considered the matter. Dote on, perhaps, or become obsessed by. We couldn't bear to see him unhappy. A tear falling from his eye made us feel wretched for days. We would have parted with our lives before we parted with that child. Alfred's voice fell silent, and he ran his hand over his bald pate. Stephen and Anne knew the danger of taking this child as their own, but they, all of us, were helpless to prevent it. That's why they named him Bane. And what was the danger? A year after the changeling was delivered to us on the birthday of Anne's true child, a mysteriarch from the High Realm came among us. At first we were honored, for such a thing had not happened in years, that one of the powerful magi of the Seventh House should so humble himself that he would deign to leave his glorious realm above and visit with us below. But our pride and our gladness changed to ashes in our mouths. Sinistrad is an evil man. He took care that we should know him and fear him. He came, he said, to do honor to the little prince. He had brought him a present. When Sinistrad lifted the babe in his arms, we knew, every one of us, whose child Bane truly was. No one could do a thing, of course, not against a powerful wizard of the Seventh House. Tryon himself is one of the most skilled wizards in the kingdom, and he is only Third House. No, we had to watch with smiles plastered on our faces as the Mysteriarch slipped that feather amulet around the baby's neck. Sinistrad congratulated Stephen on his heir and left. His emphasis on that word sent shivers of horror through all of us. But Stephen was helpless to do anything except dote on the child more fiercely than ever, even though he began to loathe the sight of him. Hugh tugged at his beard, frowning. But why would a wizard of the High Realm want a kingdom in the middle? They left us cycles ago of their own free will. Their own kingdom is wealthy beyond anything we can imagine, or so we've heard. As I've said, we do not know. Tryon has theories. Conquest is the most obvious, of course. But if they wanted to rule us, they could bring an army of Mysteriarchs down and defeat us easily. No, as I said, it doesn't make sense. Stephen knew that Sinistrad was in communication with his son. Bane is a cunning spy. The boy has learned every secret in the kingdom and has passed it all on. Of that we are certain. We might have lived with that, for 10 cycles have passed and our strength grows. If the Mysteriarchs wanted to take over, they could have done it before this. But something has happened that made it urgent for Stephen to rid himself of the changeling. Alfred glanced outside to see the boy still occupied in scouting out a city, though he was obviously tired and now sitting on the rock instead of standing. The chamberlain motioned Hugh near, whispering in his ear. Anne is with child. Ah, Hugh nodded in sudden understanding. And so they decide to get rid of one heir now that there's another on the way. What about the enchantment? Tryon broke it. 10 years of study it took him, but he managed at last. Now Stephen was able to... Alfred halted, stammering in confusion. To hire an assassin to kill him. How long have you known? From the first, Alfred flushed.
It was why I followed you.
And you would have tried to stop me?
I'm not certain. Alfred's brow furrowed, and he shook his head confusedly. I don't know.
A dark seed fell into Hugh's mind and took root. It grew fast, twisting around his brain, flowering and bearing a noxious fruit. I decided to break the contract. Why? Because the boy is more valuable alive than dead. But so were a number of men I contracted to kill. I never before broke faith. I never before broke a contract. Though sometimes I could have made 10 times the fee paid me. Why now? I risked my own life to rescue the bastard. I couldn't kill him after he tried to kill me. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over. What if the enchantment isn't broken? What if Bane is still manipulating all of us, beginning with King Stephen? Hugh looked intently at Alfred. And what's the truth about you, Chamberlain? You see it before you, sir, I am afraid, said Alfred humbly, spreading his hands. I have been in service all my life. I was with Her Royal Highness's family at their castle in New Orlandia. When Her Majesty became queen, she was kind enough to bring me with her. A slow flush spread over Alfred's face. His eyes sought the deck. He plucked nervously at the shabby clothing with his clumsy fingers. Lying does not come easily for this man, not like it does for the child, thought Hugh. Yet, like the child, Alfred is seemingly living a lie. The assassin let it drop, closing his eyes. His shoulder pained him. He felt queasy and lethargic, effects of both the poison and the heavy air pressure. Thinking of all that had passed, he twisted his lips into a bitter smile. Worst of all, his hands smeared red with the blood of countless men. He who had proudly believed himself to be masterless had been mastered by a child. Prince Bane poked his head back through the shattered side of the ship.
I think I see it. The great machine. It's off in the distance that direction. You can't see it now because the clouds have covered it. But I remember the way. Let's go there now. After all, how can it be dangerous? It's only rain.
A bolt of lightning sizzled from sky to ground, blasting a hole in the coralite. The thunderclap shook the ground and nearly knocked the boy over. That's why, said Hugh. Another lightning bolt struck with shattering force. Bane shot across the deck and crouched down beside Alfred. Rain pounded on the hull. Hail beat on it with deafening ferocity. Soon water began pouring in through the cracks in the smashed timber. Bane's eyes were wide, his face pale, but he didn't cry out. When he saw his hands were trembling, he clasped them together tightly. Looking at the boy, Hugh saw himself long ago, battling fear with pride, the only weapon in his arsenal. And it occurred to him that perhaps this was just what Bane wanted him to see. The assassin fingered the hilt of his sword. It would take only a few seconds. Grasp it, wield it, thrust it deep into the boy's body. If he was going to be stopped by magic, then he wanted to see it act, know for certain. Or perhaps he had seen